question smashtions.
Peter says, dear bon doctor and buen doctor, a heritage listener, my first experience of the good ship Twitter takement being the Pirates of the Caribbean rant back in the 2000s.
Wow.
On the back of a fairly warm review from Mark, I recently went to see The Beasts, film about a French couple who moved to Spain and get into a disagreement with their neighbours about a wind farm. It's fair to say I think The Good Doctor liked the film more than I did.
Okay.
I feel like I've seen fossils develop faster than the plot of this film, with
harsh,
its long runtime feeling very arduous. The reason for my email is that about two-thirds of the way through the film, after a significant plot twist, the protagonist's daughter comes to visit. The protagonist's daughter is played by a young, attractive female actor compared to the rest of the cast of the film, who are almost exclusively middle-aged. This is an email from Peter. I don't know if I mentioned that at the beginning, but anyway, Peter, thank you. This being a French film, I found myself thinking, I'm already not enjoying this film already. I really hope there's not going to be an unnecessary scene of that nature. In most of the film, everyone is wearing at least three layers of clothes and generally looking a bit dirty from all the farming. But lo and behold, about 15 minutes after the daughter arrives, the film decides the best way to portray the relationship between the mother and daughter is for the two of them to be in the bathroom, with the daughter undressing and getting into the shower on full show to the audience. The scene felt exploitative and took me out further of the experience as I started thinking about how the male director convinced the actress that the scene was necessary to the story. My question is, because this is smashed,
yeah.
Am I being a prude? Am I just over-projecting into the scene, or is it a case of European cinema that still has an unnecessary bias between male and female nudity in films, which is still going unchallenged?
No, it is still a problem. I confess that I hadn't, it wasn't something that particularly I noticed when I was watching that film, which I liked. And it may be that I didn't notice it because it was dramatically valid. It may be that I didn't notice it because you just become inured to it. It is certainly true that once you start thinking about the way in which nudity works on screen, it becomes very, very, very hard to ignore it. For ages and ages, cinema has had this whole thing about, you know, Mr. Happy is just, you know, is out of bounds, but female nudity is perfectly fine.
Is that a Ms. Happy? Mr. Ms. Happy.
But, you know, there is, and it is weird how even movies that that purport to be kind of progressive just get all coy about male genitalia in a way that they don't about the female body. And so there is, incidentally, a documentary coming up that addresses exactly this issue called Brainwashed. So we will be talking about this more in the coming weeks, because it is still very much an issue, and I think you are never wrong to question it. Because
you're not a prude is basically what you're saying.
No, I don't believe so. As I said, I can't actually bring to mind the specific scene that you're talking about, but that may simply be because you just get so used to it, that you don't notice. Or it may have been that there was some dramatically valid reason for it. I cannot remember off the top of my head. I can't remember. But you are certainly not wrong to question it, and it's still certainly the case that that women actors will be asked to disrobe much more than their male counterparts. And there is a very simple reason for that, which is that an awful lot of cinema has used that as a spectacle.
For, I don't think this is a spoiler.
Yeah.
We spoke to Ari Aster. We haven't reviewed Bo is Afraid, but that will be happening in a couple of weeks. But there is, for an interesting take on the male genitalia, see Ari Aster's Bo is Afraid.
Precisely. The documentary that I was talking about is called Brainwashed, Sex, Camera, Power, and it is by Nina Menkes, and investigates the politics of cinematic shot design and how this meta-level of filmmaking intersects with the twin epidemics of sexual abuse and assault and employment discrimination against women over 175 movie clips from 1986 to 2020. That is coming out very soon, and we will be talking about exactly this issue when we review that film.
Marcus says he's in Hanover. Best wishes from Hanover, brackets Germany, which is always very helpful.
As opposed to Hanover, Prague.
I imagine.
France.
Maybe
from
there
Prague.
Are. Maybe there are many.
Probably Hanover in Prague. It's no. like
so Hanover in
London,
Croydon.
Sheffield. Is it in the Netherlands?
This is particularly aimed at you.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Is there at least one thing which is not entirely perfect about The Exorcist? Because there must be.
I mean, yes, there is.
Okay. Please tell us what it is. You're not betraying a confidence.
No, I'm not. No.
Or denying your faith.
No, I'll tell you what it is, actually. During the film's most, I mean, there are, you know, during the film's most notorious sequence, there is a shot that shouldn't be there. And it was a subject, I'm treading delicately, okay. And people will know what I'm talking about. It was the subject of much conflict between William Friedkin and William Peter Blatty. And it grieved Bill Blatty for all the time that I knew him, that during the most notorious scene, the camera showed us something that really had no need nor right to be in the movie beyond sheer outrageous spectacle. And I think that shot is an error of judgment. And I think that, and I talked to Bill about it a lot, and it really, because he wrote very clearly in the script, you do not see this. And it grieved him very much that you did. And I know it's an artificial shot. It isn't what it appears to be, and it's doubles and, you know, it's Eileen Dietz and all that kind of stuff. But there is an element of the film which is imperfect. And in fact, when I wrote the BFI book, I don't think I've ever said this probably. When I wrote the BFI book about The Exorcist, I said in my original, I've still got my original manuscript, I said, it is perhaps the one shot in the film that is unforgivable. And that line got subbed out, and I didn't contest the subbing. And
why would it be subbed out?
It's, well, when you write anything, people edit stuff down, and I think my editor just thought, you're overcooking it, Kermode, because heaven knows I am never knowingly undercooked. But it was, I remember writing that line, I remember sitting there going, it is perhaps the one shot in the whole film that is unforgivable.
And does that relate to maybe to the previous email about being, about questioning?
Well, yes, it's not actually nudity. It's a grotesque moment that you do not need to see. And it is not, as I said, it's actually, you know, because obviously everything's been through the, you know, it's, you don't, it's very fleeting, and it is, but it's, you know, it is a stabbing moment that you do not need that shot. And actually, the film would be better if it wasn't there.
Marcus, thank you for the question. correspondence@kermodeaird.com. This from Rollo Treadway. Doctors, I was intrigued by the anonymous email in a recent Schmestions asking for films that aren't too difficult to deal with during dark times, as I'd asked a very similar question to my social media circle just a week or so ago. I'd found myself looking at the list of films I was intending to watch, and they were all weighty dramas which my brain was not in a fit state to handle. I asked for recommendations of recent films that were simply a good time. So I thought I'd repeat what my dear internet friends suggested to me in no particular order.
Good, thank you.
Because sometimes even the most lighthearted, you know, you were talking about Guardians of the Galaxy. You would think, yes, sure,
yeah,
go and
great.
See Volume 3, but actually it has a dark
very,
section.
Very dark side, yeah.
So on this list, Palm Springs, The Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent, Bob's Burgers Movie, Catherine Called Birdie, See How They Run, RRR, The Adam Project, Barb and Star Go to Vista Del Mar, Bill and Ted Face the Music, The Duke, Glass Onion, and also Rye Lane, which I know Mark recommended
on
the show.
Yeah.
I've not seen all of them. I am intending to, so can't vouch for how manageable they are for a mind that is hurting. But I have faith in my online acquaintances, and I believe they should all be available currently on streaming services.
I'd give Barb and Star a swerve.
Okay. Oh, and importantly, thank you so much for dealing with this kind of thing on the show. I've struggled severely with my mental health throughout my adult life, have been through some exceptionally bleak times, and it does mean a lot to know that you both care deeply and crucially are willing to talk about this regularly. Tinkety Tonkin, down with underfunding of mental health services. That's from Rollo Treadway. So, but it said, well, this could be an ongoing thing. So that's an interesting list. He's not vouching for all of those, and you've fine-tuned it. But movies that are just a good time, purely a good time, without anything under, no dark undercurrent. Don't give me that third act it's all going to. Thank you. Correspondence at conanman.com.
I mean, I have to say that the third Bill and Ted movie, which came out during lockdown, I thought was just an absolute riot from beginning to end. Do you remember that?
No, I don't think I did.
Didn't we interview the stars of it? I'm sure we did. Your memory's worse than mine.
Of course, I'm going to look it up.
Yeah.
And see what the answer to that is. Bella has the next question. I've just finished listening to a fellow churchgoer's plea for more heartwarming films, and I feel as though I'm qualified to help. I am autistic, soon to be 19-year-old, on April the 9th to be exact, who's been struggling with anxiety accompanied by periods of intermittent depression. I have found films to be a major source of comfort and escapism during this, as I enjoy getting lost in the world of film, and I also revel in the discussion of films after one has watched them. After a particular bout of terrible low mood, I watched Darjeeling Limited, directed by Wes Anderson. I frequently revisit it in my mind, as watching it felt something akin to taking a warm bath at the end of the day. It involves the tale of three brothers looking to rekindle their bond to one another whilst on a train to India. I found that empty feeling receding more and more as I was enveloped in a world of deep greens and blues. I hope this is helpful. And P.S. Following my last email about Brassed Off, my family have mocked me into both learning the difference between a CD and a DVD. Because I think Bella referred to the fact she was going to watch Brassed Off on a CD. I am now considered a rewatch following Mark's eloquent answer. And thank you to your wonderful team for getting me through the difficult periods of my life. You provide me a lot of comfort on hard days. So again, it's going back to what we're talking about movies that you could watch. Yeah. A warm bath is what's needed, and Darjeeling Limited worked for Bella.
Well, I've just checked. So it's Bill and Ted Face the Music from 2020, and it was just... It really is, and it came straight to streaming, obviously during all the awfulness, and it was just one of those things that was just a joy, an absolute joy. That's right.
Rob in Bristol, I'm a big fan of the John Wick franchise, and I've noticed something that constantly gets mentioned in reviews of these films, namely Asian martial arts cinema. Mm-hmm. Does Mark have any films within this wheelhouse that he would recommend to wickheads?
Wickheads
around the world.
I mean, I wouldn't even know where to start. I mean, it's like, you know, have you got any good action movies to recommend? The genre is so big and so wide. What are we looking for in general?
Asian martial arts.
No, but what kind of
that wickheads would like?
See, I'm trying to think what wickheads would. All right, let me come back to that. There must be something with a kind of John Wicky. I mean, obviously, weirdly enough, you know, we were talking about the John Woo thing, you know, recently with the, you know, the heroic bloodshed stuff, and there is a kind of weird intersection between martial arts. Between Asian martial arts movies and Hollywood cinema, that, you know, John Wick ties into. But what was the specific form of martial art that Keanu said that he had used in the most recent John Wick? So let me Google this, because he said there was a very, very specific type of it. It's like saying I like tap dancing and I like ballroom dancing. They're not the same thing at all. I mean, Asian martial arts movies could be anything.
Let's revisit.
Okay. All right, fine.
Okay, replacement question.
Fine.
George in Gloucestershire sends us an email to correspondence@conanman.com.
Okay.
Hello, you naughty boys. Listening to Mark discussing Love Actually on last week's Questions from Questions prompted an involuntary reflex, which I found myself automatically shouting, I hate Uncle Jamie. much to the shock of the quiet tube riders who were sat next to me.
Such a lovely scene.
For context, my girlfriend and I have a running joke, whereby every time something goes wrong in our house, or if the other is describing a bad day, or something doesn't go the way we want it to, we shout, I hate Uncle Jamie. This serves to diffuse the situation and make us both have a good smile, especially we're in different ends of the house and it's heard from afar. It made me wonder if either of you had a line from a film that you often quote out of context in certain situations. The only...
Sorry, I was just thinking about I hate Uncle Jamie, because he turns up at the door and the kids do the little dance and then he decides he has to go, I hate Uncle Jamie.
What, and remind us why they hate Uncle Jamie?
Because he turns up and then he suddenly realises that, no, he needs to go. He needs to go and go and do the thing. And so he turns up and the kids all dance, Uncle Jamie's here. And then he goes, no, I'm going. And they go, well, hey, Uncle Jamie.
Right. So the only, I don't think I have anything that's equivalent. That would be very useful. And let us know if you have a positive answer to George. We started off on take one with I Pledge Allegiance to the Band of Mr. Schneebly.
Yeah, which is...
And occasionally various members of the family do say it will test your head and your mind and your brain too. Because I think that's very good. And I'm sure other people have done, those who can do, those who can't teach, and those who can't teach Jim. Which again is funny, but it's nothing like I hate Uncle Jamie.
It's funny that we both knew that.
Is there anything that any line that?
Well, I mean, there's stuff that kind of passes into part. I mean, I think all of Spinal Tap now just gets used in general, doesn't it? I mean, everything. You know, how much more? You know, none more black, and you know, thin line between clever and stupid, and but all. So I mean, I think I have a friend who I'm going to no names, no pack drills. I have a friend who had a girlfriend, and the friend that I have, I'm telling this story badly. The good lady professor, her indoors, and I have a friend who was originally a friend. Let's call him Jeff.
Okay.
All right, Jeff was a friend of Linda's, okay? And then Jeff started going out with somebody.
Yes.
And when Jeff was going out with somebody, Jeff brought the somebody round to our house. The interesting thing about the somebody is that for various reasons within their life path, they had almost completely avoided all the pop culture that we lived and breathed, okay? And because it had got to the point that we had all known each other for so long, me and Linda and Jeff, for the purposes of this story, we would just constantly talk in pop culture quotes to each other. So you'd say none more black, or you'd, you know, any of those things, or up to 11, or, you know, we hate Uncle Jamie or whatever it is. But what was happening was that Jeff was having to constantly gloss in order to stop his girlfriend of the time feeling left out. He would very politely have to literally turn to her and explain what the joke was. And you realise after a while, firstly, that it was a kind and generous thing of him to do. Secondly, it must have been a very, very hard time for the person who's having to put up with this stuff. And thirdly, you realise that if you get into that stuff, it is very hard if you don't have the same cultural baggage to jump into the, because families develop shorthands for things, and film fans develop shorthands for things, and television fans, you just develop a kind of language. And I've done it with my kids that my there's a weird thing that that kids do now to do with, I mean, kids, I mean, our kids have grown up, but this memeing thing, which is making things shorter and shorter and shorter and shorter and shorter until the point that they are literally just almost a nothing, but it makes everyone laugh. So one of my kids had this habit of going, like, literally making a noise that was almost inaudible, and all his friends would fall about. I've just given away which child it was. Gabriel did this thing, right?
Makes a noise.
And all this shit. And I said, where does that come from? Why is that funny? And it turned out that originally it was a longer thing. And then every time they shortened it, it became funnier, to the point that it was an in-joke within their crowd. But God bless him, he explained it to me. But there is a weird thing about if you live and breathe movies, you end up using movies as shorthand, and it's very hard to step back and then explain those shorthands. So, you know, None More Black, for example, is something which, if you haven't seen Spinal Tap, it's you're going to kill it stone dead by explaining why None More Black is funny.
A couple of schmestions, slightly more straightforwardly. Sean says, "Dear Film Adjacent Television and Film Adjacent Isaacs."
Very good.
I thought so. "I have noticed that over the past few months, Mark has mentioned a particular pub a number of times, this being the Philharmonic Dining Rooms in Liverpool. I'm always delighted to hear how much Mark loves the pub, as I am a local tour guide in Liverpool.
Oh, well.
And can confirm it is a wonderful institution with a fascinating history. As a local guide, I have a huge passion for local history, but also the history and culture of pubs. They are at the very centre of communities and truly special places. And so my schmestion is as follows. What are some of your more favourite pubs from around the country or indeed the world? I suspect you will have a longer list."
You're not a kind of pub person,
don't
are you?
Don't go to the pub very much.
Have you never been a pubby person?
I think a lot of it is a London thing. So if I'm not in London, I go to the pub, and I find pubs outside. I find a lot of the pubs in London less than welcoming. After I nearly started, well, I did start a fight.
What?
My presence in a pub started a fight because I was...
I'm sorry, I'm astonished.
Yeah, well, it wasn't really my fault, Your Honour, but someone... I was visiting a pub with a friend who is a GP, and a guy who clearly been drinking came over and said, "You're Sam..." I can't remember where he, but he recognised me and wanted to make a thing about it. And was going on and on and on,
and he was in a state of inebriation.
Yes, he was, and we were both thinking, "Okay, it's time to get up and leave." And then someone else in the pub took exception to what he was doing.
This
is a long time ago.
Okay, so was this when you were on Radio One? Were you on Top of the Pops?
Yes, probably. Yeah,
okay,
Radio One, Radio Two.
Okay.
Then this other guy took exception to what he was doing, stood up, took his beer bottle off the table, smashed the beer bottle so there was the quintessential half beer bottle, and attacked this guy. And they run out of the pub having a fight. So my GP friend and I just think, okay, it's time to go. So after that, we certainly never went back to that pub, which doesn't exist anymore. And
that's just horrifying.
Yeah, so I just thought, okay, well, so that doesn't happen. So London pubs, I have, obviously they're not all like that, you know, there are a lot of very, very fine pubs in London, but I have...
absolutely horrified by that thought. And of course, you know, one of the things that, you know, the thing is, I like pubs that I like quiet pubs. I like being able to sit down, you know, me and Dave Norris sit down and have a pint and, you know, and chew over the problems of the world, and which was the pub that we started this in, which was the pub that we were talking about that I had referred to that I liked.
Philharmonic Dining Rooms in Liverpool.
So the thing with the Phil, which is, firstly, we said we had our wedding reception in the upstairs. The Phil has got, and I'm not saying this as a joke, the most spectacular male urinals you have ever seen. And I know that sounds like a joke, but it isn't. The Phil is the kind of place that literally, if you go there with lady folk, you might well end up saying to them, "I have to show you the gents," which is not a phrase that you would use under any other circumstances in a pub toilet. But they are architecturally, you know, they're astonishing. They are like the grandest urinal, you know.
So give us one other pub other than the Phil that you love.
Here's the reason that I'm slightly bridling at this. My favourite pub, I don't want to say it out loud. Because
the King's Head in Edgbaston.
Okay, but because the reason I don't want to say, and so this, the reason I don't want to is because it's an absolutely beautiful pub.
You don't want anyone else to go.
Yeah, and I know that sounds really, really terrible. So, you know, there's loads of pubs in Cornwall, you know, there's Gurney's Head and things like that. And there's, this is funny, this is having a very profound reaction with me. I am almost feeling like I don't want to answer this question because I don't want to tell you any of the places that I actually really, really like, because I want to keep them to myself. I'll tell you what I'll do. The Bell in Warberswick.
Okay, I'll say the Anchor in Warberswick, which is
the other one.
Which is the other one. And I will also, when this goes out, I will post a picture, which I've posted before, of you and I
in the Anchor.
In the Anchor. drinking very, very strong beer. I think it's rather, you know, like 13%.
And we both like Scrotic's old dirigible, isn't it?
We both look a bit 13% in the photograph. So let's hear it for the anchor in Wolveswick. Very good chips as well.
You know.
So I'll post that picture on Wednesday. Just final question from.
Can I just? I'm just going to wave this at you, just because I don't want to say it out loud. All right, but I'm going to show you. This is my favorite pub. Okay.
Okay.
But don't say it out loud.
Okay. Okay. And where is that? Ah, very good.
And it is absolute bliss because. It's got
no one else knows about it.
No one else knows about it. But because you can sit there and drink a pint and look out over the
whatever it is.
Well, I can say this, over the archipelago of islands, and it's almost like you are drinking in a Roger Dean painting.
So it's not Manchester then.
It is Manchester. Yes, it's over the Ship Canal, and it is just. You know, fabulous. I mean, I can tell you, like, historically, in Manchester, the Juicy was where we always used to go. And that was, you know, the place, when we were film critics, you know, who always said, we refer to ourselves as the dogs of Wardour Street, the place that we would always drink is the Nelly Dean. And I have no idea why we would all drink in the Nelly Dean, because back then, the Nelly Dean was a bit of a... It had the yappiest dog in the world that would bite your ankles every time you walked in. And I remember after a while, once I said to Kim Newman, Kim, why do we drink here? And Kim said, it's what we do.
Yeah, back in the day, the Cricketers in Worthing was, Broadwater actually, was particularly fine.
There was
back in the day, but I haven't been there for a couple of decades, so can't really vouch for it.
Yeah, but this is why I'm doing this, because I'm kind of doing, there's a place on Totteridge Lane called the Orange Tree, in which me and Simon Blair planned to take over the world with our band, which didn't happen. But that was always a bit of a favourite.
This is a very precise question coming next. Then, just Alex says, heritage lister, Vanguard Easter, new Canadian transplant, and occasional tweeter of the church faithful in the before times. I recently fell down an accidental rabbit hole of public information films when a Canadian friend brought the delightful. Don't put it in your mouth, to my attention. I searched YouTube to show her an equally wholesome British public information film, which was Lonely Water from 1973.
Oh, yes.
Donald Pleasant's
the spirit of
pitch-perfect voice, yes. Which has a series of children falling into lakes.
Yeah, we use that in The Secrets of Cinema on Horror Cinema, right. Because it is terrifying.
Aided by Donald Pleasant's and... The Grim Reaper.
Yeah,
it has to be said.
Right,
yeah. And then it's very
that
specific.
Branch looks unsafe.
Do you both have a favourite public information film? And is it the one about rugs on a polished floor?
What's that?
And then it says, best regards, and let's hope the Danger Yam gets arrested today. Danger Yam, I had to look up. It means Donald Trump. There's a picture. I can't even remember anyway. But that's a reference to Donald Trump.
I've never heard that.
And the public information film. There is one which has a woman boiling a kettle, which she then gets distracted and the kettle is bubbling and bubbling and bubbling. And then right at the end it says, don't boil a kettle on a boat. And then it has a wide shot of a boat explode. Does the boat explode? I think it probably does. So it's very, very niche. Don't boil a kettle on a boat. Always remember that.
I mean, the only thing in the spirit of Dark and Lonely Water, which is that key sort of public information film, which is absolutely brilliant. One of the things that I remember very clearly around that time was I developed a terror of fridges, because the story that you were told was if you ever played on a waste tip, there would always be a fridge. Never get in the fridge. Why? Because fridges don't open from the inside. Now, I believe, and I may be wrong, that since then, you cannot produce a fridge that you cannot open from the inside.
Yeah, and then when the door would shut, and then you couldn't get out.
Yeah, and it would, which is of course my great phobia is being buried alive. I mean, I have many phobias and fears, and you know, but that's the big one is being buried alive, and I have a complete panic about fridges, even now, because I saw a public information film that had a fridge on top of it, and it was like the fridge for me was gateway to hell, and I'm still nervy about fridges. So when I tell the joke about you open the fridge door, the light goes on, he does 3 minutes. That's actually just a way of getting over the fact that I'm actually scared of fridges, because everyone of my generation was taught the same thing, which is do not go near a fridge because you will get trapped in it.
Anyway, if you, I'm not sure this correspondence is going to go anywhere, but public information films, I think we probably covered all of those. But anyway, if you have a question about films, a question that's got nothing to do with films.
So another thing on the subject of pubs, there's a pub in the New Forest called the Checkers. And the story about the Checkers was Johnny Depp used to drink in there. Now, I don't know anyone who ever, ever saw Johnny Depp in there, but the story was he had a house round there, which apparently he did, and he used to drink in the Checkers. And it was whenever anyone says the Checkers, everyone says, oh, Johnny Depp used to drink in there. Do you ever seen him there? No.
No, of course not. Maybe he walked past it once or something like that. Your questions and questions for next week, please, you send them to correspondence@coburnmo.com.